Hey guys, before we roll into this next episode, I wanted to thank you all for the kind words that you've left on social media and for all of you that you have subscribed and left reviews. Those reviews help me keep this podcast free. And Matthews, one of my sponsors, was gracious enough to give me a bow to give away to one of you fans that has subscribed and left a review. So if you'd like to win a brand new Halon 32 with a 6-inch brace height in a Sitka Elevated 2 camo, all you need to do is subscribe on iTunes and leave me a review and you'll be entered to win. And I'll be giving away that bow the first week of June to one lucky winner. So thanks again and enjoy the next episode.
Hi, welcome to Interviews with the Masters, brought to you by theoutdoorinsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. This week, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about long-range shooting, long-range hunting. And I got a good buddy of mine on the phone, David Chapman of the Long Rangers and Alliance Custom Armory. So, we got some questions that I've kind of compiled, and some of you guys have asked. I remember, if you want to help me keep this free, I could use some reviews, and you know, if you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and give us a review. It helps us in our ratings, and as long as my ratings stay high, I could keep it free. So, without further ado, David, how you doing?
Pretty good, man. Just up here in South Dakota, battling a little bit of a head cold, but other than that, everything's going great. Day off from work, so couldn't be happier.
Nice, nice. I imagine it's pretty damn cold up there right now.
You know, this year, this winter's been really, really crazy. Usually in South Dakota, January and February, we don't see anything above 20 degrees, and for the last 4 or 5 days here, it's been touching 40 almost, so it's kind of like Mother Nature saying, hey, here's a teaser of what's to come, but March is our biggest snow month, so I know we still got probably another foot or two of snow to come yet and some cold snaps, so we're not out of the woods yet, but yeah, it does get really cold.
Yeah, it's definitely been a hot one this year. I mean, even here in Arizona, I mean, we typically don't start seeing 70s and 80s till, you know, March, but Jesus. It's been like, I got a javelina hunt, a rifle javelina hunt coming up here. Willie Schmidt from Peter Hunting's coming out. He drew a rifle tag, and I have a rifle tag as well, so we're going to go out hunting together, and I'm not really looking forward to this. Nakes are going to be out in full force, and you know, where we're hunting, there's a lot of Mojaves, which are, you know, a very aggressive rattlesnake. And then the fact that, you know, it's hotter, than the animals aren't going to be moving for very long in the morning. And I don't know. I'd rather be a little cold than be hot hunting any day of the week. So, but anyway.
Yep. No, I know it was a couple of years ago. I was down there hunting December and January seasons for, you know, your archery deer. And, you know, I was looking forward to hunting in the 50s and 60s up in a little bit higher elevation. And, you know, everyone's talking about how beautiful the hunting is. There's no snakes, nothing like that. And shoot, I get down there and the highs were still in the 90s. And I was thinking, what the heck? So, yeah, it's tough because, you know, a guy like me, everything's merino. So I get down there and I'm thinking, oh, I can just wear one layer of merino and be fine in this 90-degree dry temps. But, no, it sucked. Yeah. But it was a good time nonetheless.
Yeah, no, down here you got to be, I tell everybody, think layers. I've actually had it like in a January hunt down south where I show up to my glassing spot and it's literally like 9 degrees. I've actually taken my sleeping bag out of the truck and wrapped it around me while I was glassing. And then later that day, it'd be 67 degrees. I mean, it's like a 60 degree swing. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So you got to be prepared and just wear lots of layers and just shed them as you need to or add them as you need to. So,
for sure.
Anyway, I didn't have you on here to talk about the weather. So why don't you give us a little bit about, you know, run down about yourself and what you do and you know.
You know, I mean, kind of the Cliff Note version. I was born in San Diego, and my grandpa, he's from Missouri, and he did a lot of hunting growing up in the Ozark Mountains, and it always piqued my interest, but I never really had an opportunity to hunt until I was about 15 years old when my dad's job moved us here to South Dakota. So ever since then, I've kind of been, you know, hunting a lot. I started out hunting a lot of birds, you know, waterfowl and pheasants, of course, and then kind of transitioned into big game. So, you know, it's been an evolving process, you know, just like everybody's hunting passion. It evolves from one thing to the next, and you kind of dabble and figure out what you like best and go from there. But, you know, my day job, I work at a car dealership and as a finance manager. So, I don't get as much time anymore as I used to get out in the field. So the time that I do get is valuable to me for sure. So it's just, South Dakota's a great place to be able to hunt because the availability of tags for residents is great. So a lot of states have that, but some are losing it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I love South Dakota. It's actually it's definitely my top three states to go hunting. I always tell people it's like where the West meets the Midwest.
Yeah.
You go there and hunt awesome whitetail, Midwest whitetail deer, and you can go, you know, hunting for pronghorn and mule deer and not really elk. I mean, you can if you're really, really lucky.
if you're a resident and you wait 25 years. No, yeah. It's the elk's kind of tough, but sure. That's really a really good, you know, kind of synopsis of what South Dakota is. It's where Midwest meets the West. I've never heard it put that way, but, you know, we've got the Missouri River right in the middle, and, you know, there's some mule deer on the east side of the river, but not, you know, not for long, maybe, you know, 30, 40 miles, and then turns into pure whitetail. And then it's just the opposite going west. I mean, there's still the whitetail concentrations, but you get more and more mule deer the further west you head into the Black Hills and stuff. So
yeah.
It's really cool.
I've actually killed more whitetail on West River than I have in East River.
Yeah, you know, I don't doubt that, you know.
You know, Black Hills and all that stuff.
Yep.
You know, all those badlands out there, kind of like, you know, just a couple. I mean, I used to fly into Gillette, Wyoming,
sure,
and cross over from there. Shot my biggest, actually my biggest antelope is from there, up at the Buffalo area, and my biggest mule deer is from there too. I shot a 180-inch mule deer with my bow,
sure,
right around that same area.
Huh.
So,
yeah,
but
no,
I shot quite a few whitetail out of there too. Three different whitetail.
Yeah,
I won over by Sioux Falls too in the cornfield. But,
yeah, it's crazy how you can go. You can be on the east half of the state, and it's like, you know, kind of a good analogy would be it's like cardboard with wind. And then you get, you know, further west, and you get into the Black Hills, which obviously are part of the Rockies, and, you know, you get into some pretty rough country. You know, I think people generalize South Dakota as being flat, and most of it is, you know, but
yeah,
you know, the further west you get, the more challenging the terrain is, and obviously the bigger deer hide out pretty well in that stuff. But these corn-fed whitetail out here on the east half of the state are nothing to pass up.
No, they're big, big bodies, some of the guns on that side over there.
Heck yeah.
Well, so tell me a little bit about the Long Rangers and what you guys are doing over there.
You know, the Long Rangers is, you know, it's a long-range hunting show, long-range rifle hunting show, and the guys who started it, Brent and Chris Meyer, they also own Alliance Custom Armory. So it's kind of a nice deal because there's two companies working hand in hand to help each other out, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you can get double value, you know, it's always good. But, you know, what they did is they had this vision for a rifle company, and Chris, he's the engineer behind it, that really the hands-on guy as far as that's concerned. And Brent's really the, you know, he's kind of the businessman in the whole operation. So, but Chris started building a couple rifles just for him and himself, or himself and friends here, 6-7 years ago, I believe. And, you know, they performed really well. And him being just a OCD personality, you know, he was able to take and really reduce the tolerances on, say, a factory rifle or what you find in a factory rifle and get into that custom rifle. Those thresholds or the expectancies from a custom rifle or you know, what you find in a custom rifle and what you pay for it to be exact, you know, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they started Alliance Custom Armory and kind of, you know, everything's been rolling since then. My involvement with them actually started, you know, John, we've been friends for quite some time, 5 or 6 or 7 years here. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was real big on the pro staff thing and, you know, social media and, you know, photography support and stuff like that. And I just, how I happened to come across these guys is I saw a post on some random group in Facebook, Alliance Custom Armory, and I didn't have a custom rifle. I never had one before that. I always shot factory rifles.
Right.
And I said, well, let me check this out. So I just clicked on his page and I saw Columbia, South Dakota. And, well, I didn't even know where Columbia was, to be honest. Well, it turns out it's only about an hour and 45 minutes from me. It's a little town with a population of, you know, smaller than most football teams. And, yeah. And so I was like, holy cow. So, you know, I just reached out to Brent and said, hey, you know, what I noticed, and hopefully he doesn't, you know, get too mad, but I noticed there were some lacking in photography, some quality photos and stuff like that. And I thought, yeah, this is a small company that obviously is trying to cut its teeth. Maybe I could help them out. And so I just called him and said, hey, you know, I'm from Watertown. I'm local here. I got some experience with the camera. You know, maybe we could work hand in hand and help your company grow. And you can scratch my back at the same time and I can get my first custom rifle. And to be honest, right. That's how it started. And it kind of just grew, you know, I ended up filming, parts of a good majority of season one of their show. So I think 8 or 9 episodes of the 13, which airs on the Pursuit channel. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then season two, I filmed another half of them and it took me all over, you know, not all over the United States, but down to Texas a few times, Colorado on coyote hunts on snowshoes and, you know, all over South Dakota. And it was just a good time, good experience for me. So it really was beneficial to both parties, you know, and we've kind of just stuck together ever since. And now I'm on my fourth Alliance build and, you know, Brent's on season 3 of the Long Rangers is airing right now. And, you know, they're both doing well, more and more rifles selling all the time. And so it's really been a really good deal for both parties. And it's been kind of cool to see the company grow, you know? So that's really my involvement with them. And you know, it's changed my mindset as far as rifles and expectations from a rifle. And really, you know, custom rifle is really, it's just a tool. You're just taking a tool and refining right. it and making it right. so that you're able to make more ethical shots at longer ranges, you know? So, but
absolutely.
At the same time, it's only one piece of the puzzle, you know, you got more than just the gun that is involved in it. So,
of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. There's also the bullets, and I had this conversation, a similar conversation in a couple of different areas. You know, with the same thing with archery, and same thing even filming. Okay,
mm-hmm.
The cameras that we have are far better or far more precise than the operator, and same thing with the bow, or you know, even factory rifles, you know, to an extent,
yep.
you
yep.
know, really will outshoot what most people can do. So it really comes down to, once you have the best of the best, learning how to use it and perfecting your skill set, you know, to be the best that you can be.
So, yeah, that's 100% the case, you know. A good example, or, you know, a way to look at it is, most of us guys, we're shooting off bipods in the rear bag, you know,
mm-hmm.
And you can be fairly accurate, and that's probably with anywhere from a 7 to 10 pound rifle, probably 9 to 12 pounds with glass and a bipod and fully loaded. But a good comparison would be these bench rest guys that are shooting, you know, 20 pound rifles on, you know, this, this freaking, you know, system that actually, it's a hydraulic system that pulls the trigger for them, you know, and those guns at 600 yards are shooting what you and I hope to shoot at 100 yards. But you know, the tool is capable. It's just how you practice and make sure that you are holding on target and, you know, working on your breathing and, and obviously a good, consistent, crisp trigger squeeze and stuff like that, that's going to allow that rifle to do what it was built to do, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's just like with archery, when I first got into it, and you're a big bow hunter, so you know all this way more than I do, but, you know, you start tweaking your bow and you know, bear shaft tuning and all that stuff, and, you know, it gets pretty precise to where, you know, guys like you are able to take these, you know, 60, 70, 80-yard shots or whatever you take and be just as effective as a guy who doesn't tune his bow or doesn't practice at 30 yards, you know. Right. It's the tool's capable. It's just how you use it in your hands, you know.
Absolutely. So I got a few questions for you.
Okay.
One thing that comes up all the time, and it seems like a pretty simple, you know, give a general answer, but I get the question about, you know, ammo, hand loading versus mass manufactured or custom loads.
Sure.
What's your take on?
Well, you know, as time progresses here, these companies, Hornaday, Nosler, you know, Federal with their gold medal match in the 308, what's happened is these companies have gotten very good at producing a run-of-the-mill factory round. So, you know, it's not to say that you can't get great results and sufficient results out of factory ammo, but what happens is all these companies, they're, you know, in the age of litigation that we're in right now, they are forced to load their ammo to well below safe, if you know what I mean. As far as max charge, they stay away from max charge. They, in fact, if you look at a reloading manual, you know, they'll say in there 93% or 90% or 87% charge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they stay below that so that someone doesn't go in there at 100% and has a tight chamber, because, you know, basically what happens is these factory rifles have pretty big chambers, and that's to allow for a bunch of different factory ammunition so that you don't get increased pressure. So they load their overall length. So that would be, you know, the distance from the base of the round of the case to the ogive, which is the slope from the point to the bearing surface or where it's full bore, you know? So if you're shooting a 7mm, it's 0.284, or 300 drum, it's, you know, 0.308 is the outside diameter of the bullet. And if that outside diameter is touching where your rifling starts, you'll have a spike in pressure. So what happens is these guys, you know, they load them short so that you've got room so you don't have an increase in pressure or run into a situation where you're blowing up in action, you know, because that ultimately can happen. And so what happens is they load them to kind of fit all guns, if you know what I mean. And what you give up there is obviously velocity a little bit. But nowadays, you take a bullet like a Berger VLD, and it's very seating depth sensitive. So seating depth obviously is the distance between the bullet and your rifling, where the bullet engages the rifling. And, you know, you're talking about 5 to 10 thousandths of an inch can make the difference between a half a minute group and, you know, 15 thou, or, you know, or 15, you know, just under a fifth of a minute, you know.
Wow.
0.20. Yeah, just off of 10 thousandths of an inch, which is minute. I mean, it's so small that if you put them side by side, you wouldn't see any difference, you know. But so these guys have loaded these factory rounds to kind of fit every gun, and it's fine, you know. There's ammo out there that is shooting quarter minute out of factory guns, which is very, very good, you know.
Right.
It takes a really experienced shooter to shoot quarter minute, you know.
Right.
So, but what, you know, the benefit of hand loading is that you can control, you know, exactly where that bullet's seated and how much powder is being thrown into that case. And that allows you to really maximize what the gun's capable of, because velocity equals downrange energy, and it obviously, you know, allows you to maximize the ballistic coefficient of a given bullet, you know. So that to me is what the advantage is. Plus, you know, I'm like such a meticulous person to begin with. I really like the process, you know. I enjoy shooting a target and knowing, man, I had to develop that load and experiment and mess with stuff, and there was frustration along the line, but I was able to find something that shot consistently and shot really well at every yardage so that I could take it to the field and know that if I got a deer at 500 yards, I know that, I'm going to be able to dial my scope and hold for wind, and my bullet and gun are going to do what it's supposed to do. It's just on me to figure out what I need to tell it to do. So, not to get off on a tangent there, but there are great options in factory ammo. I think that just reloading obviously allows you to maximize and get the most out of your equipment.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, just because there's a lot of guys out there that don't have, like myself, I don't have the time to reload at all. Want to. I've been thinking about it, especially since my freaking bullets are like retarded expensive. If I have a 300 ROM. And, I buy custom ammo. I probably save, 70% or more if I was actually reloading. So it would be a big buy. I just don't have the time. So I don't shoot enough for me to worry about it. But what would you suggest if somebody was going to go to factory ammo? Not quite, I guess that's kind of, I mean, I don't know if there's a specific brand that you think does a better job, at least consistency-wise, Like you said, they may or may not be loading all the way, to max charge or whatever, but there may, for me, when I was shooting factory loads, in my last gun, I had a Remington Sendero 300 ROM also. And it was primarily a factory gun. I had some work done to it, trigger, stuff like that, but nothing super major done to it. I was shooting I found that Remington core locked shot very, very well and was very consistent out of that gun. But, and then I didn't have that same consistency. Is there one manufacturer over another, or is it just that from bullet to bullet, caliber to caliber, you just got to find?
Yeah, and that's, that's exactly, it's really gun to gun, cartridge to cartridge, because you can have, say a Savage long-range hunter in 6.5 Creedmoor, and the chamber dimensions and the diameter of the barrel and where you're going to find, the consistent node in the barrel, so where the barrel whip is consistent. And it can be completely different than, say, a Tika, CTR, which is kind of it's more of a PRS-style gun, but it's a 6.5 Creedmoor as well, so that's where I draw the comparison. Its reaction to the round is going to be completely different. So you really, what you have to do, and when I used to shoot factory ammo before I started loading, what I would do is I'd go and I'd pick up a box of 20, of everything I could find in any given cartridge or whatever I was shooting. And I would go to the range and I'd shoot groups with it and find the one that shot the best. If the best one, a good example would be like, I had a Savage long range hunter in 6.5 Creedmoor, and it loved Winchester 140 grain ballistic silver tips. I mean, it would shoot half a minute. And this is kind of in the transition period when I was starting to get serious in hand loading. And it would shoot half a minute. And I was like, holy cow, that's good stuff. Well, I started loading and got it down to well less than that. But half a minute is very sufficient for most shooters, I mean, that's you're talking about, if you can be as consistent as a gun, you'll shoot a 5-inch group at 1,000 yards. So, it's a little over 5 inches, would be half MOA. But that's really, really good. I mean, that's inside the heart of a big game animal. So, for me, I think guys that are shooting factory guns and don't have the luxury to hand load, if they're going to shoot factory ammo, then that's the way to go. But, if it's a guy like yourself who's got a factory gun, or I'm sorry, a custom rifle, Best of the West and Alliance and Gunworks and all of these manufacturers now offer custom ammo. So what a guy can do, and it's well worth the investment to call, send your gun in, and have them develop a load for you. And that way, you can be, 2 weeks out from a hunt, can't find your ammo that you need, and say, hey, Jim, I need 100 rounds of 300 rum of my recipe. And they will have it on file. At least I know that with Alliance they do in Gunworks. They'll have it on following, you know, John Stallone, 300 rum, boom, and they'll build you up 100 rounds and send them out to you. And for what most guys are charging, you know, if you take like a Nosler trophy grade, it's like $60 a box for 7 mag or, you know, any of these, you know, Magnum calibers. $60 a box. Well, most guys or most rifle manufacturers, custom rifle manufacturers that do custom load development, are charging anywhere from $3 to $5 a round. Well, you do the math. I mean, you may spend a little more, but you're going to have something that you.
But in the end, it's worth exactly, and that's what I'm doing right now. You know, so Best of the West built my gun. They developed the load for me. So I'm buying the ammo from them. So, and like you were saying, when I bought Noslers because that's all I could find. I couldn't find the ammo that I set my gun up, my old gun up on, and those Noslers were $90 a box. You know.
Yeah.
That sports was worth.
Well, $300. It's like you're creeping up on 100 grains of powder in that thing. You know. That's,
yeah.
That's a lot of oomph, you know.
So.
Well, yeah,
that's
the best way to go, I think.
Yeah. I feel, you know, confident that I'm going to get, you know, the right consistency. My gun now, like I said, Best of the West built it, and, you know, I'm shooting out to 900 yards with, I mean, amazing accuracy. And I handed my gun to my cameraman, and he's, all right, let me shoot it. And he's like, first shot, takes a 700-yard shot at an 8-inch rock, you know, blows it up, So, yeah, there's a lot to be said about having a good custom rifle. And like you said, you know, Alliance and Best of the West and, you know, Gunworks, these guys have been doing it for a while and putting together real quality equipment.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you know, and one of the things, too, is it's crazy when you see there's like an instantaneous addiction that comes with shooting something that far for the first time. And, you know, we've been on these hunts where we have, say, a guide or, you know, someone else who, you know, a good example would be Ruben Ramos of Ramos Knives. He ordered a gun from us, had never shot a custom rifle, nothing. And he ordered a gun from us. Well, we delivered it by hand on this hunt in Texas. And so we had some steel plates set out at, I think they were like 400 and 600 yards. And we had like a 3-inch circle painted in the center. And, you know, Brent and Chris were like, okay, here's your correction, you know, dial it to that and then hold dead on. And his face, this is a 45-year-old man, the way his face lit up when that thing hit dead center on the first shot, he's hooked for life. I mean, and same thing with friends, like your cameraman, I'm sure in the back of his mind, he's probably like, I need one of these. Because you just, if you've never experienced it before, you just go, holy crap, now I can see how these guys who have these TV shows make these 800, 900, 1,000-yard shots with confidence because the gun does it. You know what I mean? I mean, they practice, but the gun's capable of it, you know?
Yeah, of course. You can't.
And I don't want to – a little disclaimer asterisk there. I'm not saying everyone should shoot that far. I'm not saying that's what the long rangers aims to do, but, you know, it's nice to know that when you have the opportunity and the conditions are right, your equipment and yourself is capable of it, you know?
Right. Well, I'm glad you said it because – I've been able to shoot even with my factory gun, you know, like I said, it was a higher end factory gun that had some work done to it. I was fairly consistent out to, you know, on the targets at 800 yards, but I guess, I don't know if this is the bow hunter in me or just the hunter mentality in me. I always try to stalk in as absolutely close as possible. Whether I can shoot 700 yards or not, like, you know, I'm addicted to coos deer hunting, and it's probably one of the few things that I really enjoy doing with the rifle.
Yeah,
and I would, you know, back in the day, I would just, you know, I would take shots wherever I found them from, you know, I would take, and then I was like, you know what? I stalk within. My dogs are going crazy over here. Excuse me one second. I'm going to take a break. Hey, Shut up.
Hey, don't edit that out.
Yeah, right? Dumbass dogs. Freaking Amazon guy just showed up and dropped a box off outside and going nuts.
Surprised it wasn't the drone.
Yeah, right? I swear to God, Amazon shows up to my house every damn day. My wife is like, I can't even blame her all the way because I buy a lot of shit.
I buy more than my wife on Amazon, that's for sure.
All right, so, yeah, well, I used to basically, when I started hunting these deer, I would just shoot them from, you know, wherever I can get to that I knew was within my range. And now, you know, I started several years ago, probably like the last 7-8 years, I started saying to myself, I'm like, dude, you get within 100 yards of these things all the time with your bow. Yeah. And you're always like, I wish I had my rifle because you can't close the last, you know, 40 yards or so to make a shot. And so I just stopped. I stopped doing the shoot far. I got this gun that can shoot, you know, 1,000 yards. And
yep.
Now I'm like, now I'm stalking it to, you know, less than 200 almost every time to make the shot. And I do it for a number of reasons. One, I like the challenge of it. Two, I want to make the most ethical shot I can make. And three,
sure.
It makes for a lot better film for the
100%.
Show.
So, yep.
You know,
yep,
you can see the animal better and everything else. So, but it's like
what,
you said, it's nice to know that you can shoot.
Well, and it's just like with archery. I mean, you know, I used to practice on targets out to 120.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't mean I'm going to take a 120-yard shot on an animal. You know, I shoot steel or, you know, we shoot steel out to a mile on occasion.
Right.
Well, where there's no way in hell we're going to shoot or even attempt to shoot an animal at a mile. You know, it's just, it makes it so that those yardages that are half of that are much more comfortable and much more,
of course,
natural, you know. And there's times where, you know, instead of looking, there's never been a situation where I said, holy cow, this animal is too close to me. I need to back up,
yeah.
You know. It's always, what's the closest point between me and him that I can get to, and is that distance inside of my, it's just like when you look at potentially stalking an animal with your bow. You know, if that animal is in wide open ground and he's heading perpendicular to you in wide open ground, you're probably not going to attempt to make a stalk. You're going
right.
to say, well, I can't get inside 100 yards no matter where I go to. We got to wait till he's in a better position, right? And,
yep.
You know, whereas if you can range a rock between you and the animal and you know it's 40 or 50 yards from the animal and he's just there feeding calm, then you know you can stalk to that rock and make your shot. But, you know, it's hunting is hunting at the end of the day. My whitetail this year, he was down in a draw. We were up on a hill, and the closest I could get was some hay bales, and it was, you know, 480 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the closest I could get. And I knew that was well within my range. The wind was cooperating, and everything was – stars were aligned to make a shot. If I could have got closer, I sure would have. But, you know, it's not that I was like, oh, man, should I make the shot? Should I take it? Can I? You know, it was just knowing this is the closest point I can get to, and, yes, it's inside of my effective range. So that's what it's all about still. These guys, like, you know, you watch the Best of the West and the Gunworks show and the Long Rangers, and there's times when they take 400-yard shots, which for them is – you know, they're probably not even dialing most of the time on a 400-yard shot. You know,
right,
they know what their reticle subtensions tell them to do, where they need to be. But there are times when those guys make shots where even I go, wow, that was impressive, you know. So, you know, it's just, it's not necessarily how far can we shoot the animal. It's just, are we prepared to shoot them at a longer range, you know.
Right,
so,
yeah.
And that's how I think all of them. I can't really speak for those guys, but I know that that's how, you know, the Long Rangers approaches it. That's why most of our shots are probably 400 to 500 yards. Some of them stretch out to 900, 1,000, but that's a rarity, really.
Yeah, no, like you said, you know, you equated it to shooting your bow, you know, at 120. You know, I did that for years and years and years. I always shot out. I would shoot out to 150 yards with my bow.
Yeah.
so that I would have the confidence to make a 70-yard shot if I wanted to, which is a long bow shot, you know.
Sure. And that practice is really what allows you to do it. And, you know, I know that for me, when my max effective range varies, you know, there are some days, you know, I could be coming into a hunt and haven't shot my gun other than to verify dope, you know.
Right.
And I know that I'm not going to take anything outside of 500 yards. And then there's days, you know, there's seasons where, you know, I shot my gun so much 2 years ago, I shot my gun so much that, you know, at 800 with the, you know, if the conditions were okay, I wouldn't hesitate. And that's max effective range is definitely something that varies from shooter to shooter and even within yourself, you know. So that's something to keep in mind, too, is the practice is very important, but you kind of have to be, you know, cognizant of what your practice has been leading up to the hunt.
Right. Well, what are some of the things you do to practice?
You know, I just send a lot of bullets downrange. You know, last year I think I shot close to 6,000 rounds, and it was between 5,000 and 6,000, and that was amongst, you know, three different guns: a 7 mag, a 6.5 Creedmoor, and a 6 Ackley improved. But I had a lot more time. You know, I wasn't working full time, so. But for practice, what I work on is, honestly, I put a lot of effort into load development and finding a round that the rifle likes. But what I also do is I verify at, you know, shorter distances that load too very frequently. So I may go out and develop a load, and let's say I shoot quarter minute with it. Well, I'll go load, you know, three groups or five groups up at that same charge, same seating depth and everything, and go shoot five separate groups and make sure that it wasn't a fluke, you know. That's part of the load development process. And then what I'll do is, let's say I'm going to start stretching it out and verifying my dope and getting a ballistic profile put together for that gun and that cartridge. What I'll do is I'll shoot another group that day at, say, 200 yards and know that my zero's set to where I can start adjusting with what the ballistic profiling tool tells me. So whether that's a G7 BR2, or which is a rangefinder that gives you a ballistic solution using, you know, it's got a weather station built into it. So it takes, you know, barometric pressure, humidity, temperature, all that stuff. And it calculates it in there and tells you what you need to use as far as the solution on your rifle scope to shoot at any given yardage. So another tool is a Kestrel BR2, or I'm sorry, a Kestrel wind meter, which is also a weather station. It kind of does the same thing, except it doesn't range. But it'll give you a ballistic solution and tell you what you need to do. But, you know, if you take an example of how you know, people can kind of be misled on this, is you can take and run your gun and shoot through a chronograph. And let's say you're, you know, it's this 28 Nosler. Say it's a 28 Nosler and I'm getting 3,050 feet per second, right?
Right.
If I plug that into the BR2 or into a Kestrel or even a phone app on my iPhone, chances are it's not going to be dead on. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to shoot at, say, 400 yards, right? If your zero is 200, you shoot at 400 yards. And if you're 2 minutes low, you're going to have to mess with the velocity or the BC that you input into whatever device you're using in order to get it to line up and give you the correct profile, right? So I practice a lot with that. So verifying dope at those longer yardages, and dope is an acronym for data on personal equipment, okay, or data on previous engagements. There's two ways you can look at it. But what I do is I verify at those longer yardages that, you know, that everything is lining up. And I practice a lot throughout the year leading up to the hunt at those longer yardages, because the temperature changes, your density altitude changes, even at the set, you know, I'm at 1,700 feet. One day I might go out there and it might, you know, 500 yards might tell me I need 8 minutes or 10 minutes. And I might go out there a week later and it might tell me I need 11 minutes or nine, you know. So elevation usually correlates with density altitude, but density altitude is the true component that, you know, that determines what your bullet does. So, you know, I think in the age of ballistic turrets, where, you know, guys have gotten used to, you know, ordering a laser engraved ballistic turret for their load.
Right.
You know, that is only good at very close to or at one density altitude value. So, you know, if you're shooting in Arizona where you're at, I don't know, you're at probably 100 feet above sea level, and you go on a hunt in Montana where you're at 7,000 feet, that ballistic turret is not going to match up. Chances are. So,
right.
You know, it's better to just stick with the factory turrets and an external calculation device like a BR2 or something that actually takes in real-time data and gives you a solution. So, not to get off on a tangent there, but, yeah, I mean, practice and verifying over and over again is the fastest way or the best way to you know, ensure that you know your rifle well and just, you know, have experience with it, knowing that what kind of wind. One thing is elevation is absolute. Mm-hmm. So if you have a G7 BR2 or a Kestrel or a Phonak or anything like that, whatever your elevation correction is going to be an absolute number. So that is not it gives you the solution, and it's going to be right as long as it intakes the data properly, right? The
right.
One thing that does vary that's not absolute is wind. Mm-hmm. And so the biggest thing to practice on is wind. You know, a lot of guys are fair weather shooters and they go out and shoot on just nice days. But, you know, if you don't know what your gun's going to do with the 10 mile an hour, 45 degree, you know, quartering towards wind
right.
at 500 yards, then you're not prepared to take that shot, you know? So, the biggest thing I think is wind. And you'll hear that from a lot of those guys that, you know, they can't, you can't stress enough how much wind affects a bullet.
For sure. Well, you know, I took in everything you said. And for me, not that I want to disagree with you, because it's obviously it's going to be more accurate if you're taking each individual shooting situation and then putting all the data in and coming up with a shooting solution. But as a hunter, I don't always feel like you have the time, number one,
sure.
to do that. Two, unless you can afford a BR2 or whatever, it's, you know, you're carrying a bunch of extra stuff with you. I really like the drop compensating turret. And for me, like on my Best of the West and my Husqvarna, I have, and I know you guys use Husqvarna too on some of your builds. I have a dual turret system, which gives me
sure.
an elevation range, and I have several of those turrets. So if I know that I'm going, I have them all the way up to 11,000 feet, I think.
Sure.
So if I know I'm going to go hunt alpine with my rifle, that's the turret system I throw on there. So I have the, you know, a very close, I've taken it out and field tested it, and I've honestly, for hunting accuracy, and I'm talking 700 yards and less, it performs amazing. For me, I think it's like, okay, it's kind of simple, stupid, dial it and go.
Yep.
Doesn't need, you know, yeah, who cares if I'm 2 inches low and I'm shooting at, you know, really, in the grand scheme of things, my target's, you know, a 15-inch by 15-inch square.
Yep.
So, like, I think having something that's fast and simple and not adding a bunch of, you know, because let's face it, you shot 6,000 rounds. I don't think I've shot 6,000 rounds in my life.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I don't think I've shot through that. First thing, it cost me $3,000 in bullets to shoot 6,000 rounds. You know, and shooting the caliber that I'm shooting, I'd probably burn out that barrel.
yeah, you're right. You would.
So, you know, the other thing is, this is like, I really think unless you're trying to achieve that, like, that next level of shooting, or if you're going to be a competition shooter or whatever, I really like having a turret system. I think it's
it's a good solution. Don't get me wrong. I'm not disagreeing with the system, you know, and like I said, if you have a turret system that's built for 100 degrees and, you know, a density altitude of where you're at, but you don't have one for those 11,000 feet situations, then you're setting yourself up for failure.
Oh yeah,
but
oh,
you
yeah,
do.
Yeah, for sure.
So if you have a step turret system like you've got, then you're fine. You know,
yeah.
I think, you know, it was just kind of addressing a misnomer that, you know, this turret, you know, these elevation graduations are going to be on for my gun no matter where I'm at. You know, as
right,
long as people
right,
understand
right.
that there's variables that change that. But yeah, for you, I mean, that's plenty. You know, that's going to get the job done because those it's a science, you know, what those guys have and what they use for their ballistic profiling and laser engraving on the turrets. It's, you know, they plug it in, and like I say, elevation's absolute. It's an absolute number on that turret system too. So
yeah.
As long as you have the turret system that coincides with your current, you know, atmosphere, then it's plenty fine. You know, I guess for me, I was
right.
Just
it's gonna be close.
You know,
it's not gonna be exact. Like what you're doing is exact.
Well, and it very well may be exact because, you know, it takes kind of a lot of variation in density altitude to affect it. But, you know, if I'm shooting, like I was saying that one week I can shoot with one solution and the next week it can be completely different. If I'm shooting at 500 yards and it's, you know, there's a minute in difference, that's 5 inches. Well, without my systems, I wouldn't be able to know that it was because of that. I would just assume that something's, you know, if I was a beginner and I had ordered a Best of the West gun and I got one elevation set up and then I go out and shoot somewhere else, I'm going to start wondering if something's wrong with my gun or what I'm doing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, for
Whereas
sure.
If you understand that there are variables that affect the elevation solution, then, you know, you can sure compensate for that and be just fine. So
yeah.
That's kind
well,
of
it comes back to where we started with this whole thing is understanding and learning your equipment, for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, and like I said, I wasn't really trying to – I didn't want to use the word argue with you. I didn't want to, like, downplay what you were saying.
At
the same time, I didn't want people to think that, you know, they had to run out and buy a $3,000 rangefinder either.
No. And maybe I wasn't clear enough about, you know, my comparison there, but, you know, definitely understood, and I get how you're stating your case for the turret system, and that makes 100% sense.
Well, we started talking about practice and stuff like that. So let me ask you this. If a guy doesn't have or a girl doesn't have their, you know, the ability or the time or the you know, they get a very short amount of time and, you know, funds are limited. We can't shoot 6,000 rounds. What are some of the things a guy can do practice-wise? You know, do you have like a regime that you do or something that you follow that kind of help? Like I have a bunch that I developed for bow hunting, you know, that puts me in different scenarios and situations that allow me to have almost like a muscle memory when I'm presented with that shot.
Sure.
What are some of the things somebody could do to improve their shooting?
Well, you know, in hunting situations, you know, if we were to rely on just the prone position,
mm-hmm.
You may lose opportunities, you know. Most of the time where I'm at in South Dakota, I'm either from an elevated point, you know, if I'm out west, or here on the east, you know, the east side of the state, you know, we've got a lot of open area. You know, there's mm-hmm. cornfields with shelter belts, but it's primarily flat ground. So for me, I do spend most of my time practicing prone. I do some sitting with a longer bipod.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, my effective range, you know, cuts down very fast when I go to anything but prone. And that may be a fault of mine, but, you know, for me to be confident, I want to be in a prone position where I know that rifle is dead. You know, it's not moving at all or moving very, very, very minimally. Anytime you get further from the ground, the rifle is going to be less steady. At least for me. So real-world situations is, you know, most of the time there's some variance between cold bore and a warm bore on a rifle. So a good tool would be to go out and check what your cold bore performance is on your rifle. So rather than zeroing off of a warm rifle, let's face it, if you're taking a second or third shot, that animal's probably running, you know?
Yeah.
So groups are a good way to verify your initial zero, but if your rifle throws one a half a minute high or a half a minute right or a half a minute low on the cold bore shot, then that's really where your zero point should be. So what you can do is you can go out and just throw one round in there and see where you hit, you know, and then right. verify it, of course. You know, maybe the next time, you can let your rifle cool down for 15 or 20 minutes and then shoot another one and see exactly what kind of cold bore groups you're putting together. I think I listened to Cody Vorman's podcast, and he talks something like that where he'll take just one round and run out to the range and shoot one round and then go home. That I like shooting, I guess. You know, I like to spend more time at the range, I guess. And mm-hmm. so what I'll do is I'll get out there and I'll shoot one round and see where it hits and then let my rifle cool down and shoot another one and see where that hits, and that's your true cold bore performance, you know.
Right. Right. So I have a very similar thing I do with bow hunting. I call it, you know, first shot pin checking.
Sure.
And this is more of a trying to figure out what your effective hunting range is. You know, mm-hmm. most guys will start at 20 yards, and then they'll work their way back to 80 yards or whatever their last pin is.
Yep.
You don't get that, you know. You go out in the field, you're presented with an 80-yard shot, and it's not like you're going to walk up to them and say, hey, stand there, wait for me to warm up, and let me back up, and then I'll shoot you, you know. But
exactly.
So I just go out and, you know, you walk out first shot, go to your very furthest pin, and you shoot. And I could see how that would be very useful, you know, type of training. One, like you said, verifying cold bore, but also you being able, you know, it's the same thing. You warm it up, taking warm-up shots at 100 yards at a target, and then you go and shoot, you know, your further distances. You're giving your body a warm-up. You're giving the barrel a warm-up. You know, it's like, it's just not the way it works, you know. You get out there, it's 15 degrees in the morning, you're freezing your ass off, and, you know, you see a bull elk at 500 yards, you're you know.
Yeah,
you're not
going
to have time to warm up.
It's just like an athlete, you know. I mean, they get a chance to warm up before a game. Unfortunately for us, you know, we don't really get that opportunity, you know. So sometimes if you're camping, you know, you can shoot some groups while you're in camp with your bow. Obviously with the rifle, it's a little tougher to just go out and throw a target out there and shoot 3, 6, 9 rounds, you know, and warm up your gun. But by the time you get to your spot, you're going to be back to cold bore anyway. So
right.
Got to rewind. So
for sure. Well, cool, man. That's all I got for you. Words of wisdom you want to pass on, anybody?
No, you know, I think that one thing I would want to say is that I don't ever want people to think that they need a custom rifle, you know? It's personally, I think everyone would benefit from one or enjoy shooting one. But, you know, the same type of results can be had with the factory rifle as long as you put the time in. You know, there's plenty of guys that do it year in and year out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would venture to say that there's guys with factory rifles that are just as good as guys with custom rifles, you know. The main focus would be practice and load development. And that's it. You know, it doesn't matter what gun you've got. And like we were saying earlier, half a minute, you know, even 3/4 of a minute, mm-hmm. accuracy is plenty good, you know.
Yeah.
It's not that you need to shoot single digit groups. It's just, it's nice to know that your equipment can do that. But regardless, it's not a necessity, in my opinion, anyway.
Well, none of it's a necessity. I mean, think about it. I mean, and I equate, this goes back to every expensive piece of equipment you could think of out there for hunting, you know, going from shooting a $200 bow or shooting a $1,000 bow or using $50, you know, Walmart binos or using, you know, $2,500, you know, piece of glass. You can be as effective with those things.
100%.
But the learning curve is so much greater and there's so much more. I mean, when you shoot a really forgiving bow or you shoot a really accurate rifle, there's a certain amount of human error that gets taken out of it.
Sure.
In my opinion. And
yeah, it compensates for it, for sure.
Yeah.
It does, to some degree.
You know, and glass, okay? So, like, yeah, can you see something 500 yards away with a, 10x50 Bushnell or whatever that you picked up for $200? Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
But I probably saw it 20 minutes before you did with my 15x56. So
yeah, and you already know how wide... You already know how wide it is, how deep the forks are, and how long the main beams are,
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with camouflage and everything else. It's like, yeah, can I kill a deer in my long johns and flannel? Yeah, shit, I did it when I was a kid, but
yeah,
I would much rather not freeze my ass off, and I would much rather, blend into the environment as best I can.
Yeah.
So, it's just all
the one thing. The one thing I would say, not to get too drawn out here, the one thing I would say that you really, any shooter, no matter what the rifle is, should not, cut corners on is a scope where they plan on dialing.
Mm-hmm.
And because if that scope, when you dial, doesn't track and doesn't return to zero, then it's
right.
not going to be consistent. So, the biggest, and you hear this all the time, whatever you spend on your rifle, you should spend twice on your scope.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're buying a $3,000 to $4,000 rifle, that's tough.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you're buying a $600 to $800 factory gun, you should at least spend that on the scope, or at least make sure you get something that is going to be applicable for your shooting
yeah.
conditions. Where if you need
for
to dial,
sure.
you got to get something that's repeatable, or it's just not going to work. So, but everything else, yeah, I agree 100%. There's guys, Milo Hansen, he still has the world record typical. He wasn't wearing any camo when he killed that buck. There's just, I've got a buddy who smokes cigarettes in his tree stand, and he kills good deer every year. But, it definitely, for guys like me that are not really good hunters, I need every edge I can get. So I'm going to get the gear that I can get,
Well, here's the thing. So that brings up a whole nother can of worms, what you just said, but I'm not going to get into too much about this guy that smokes in his tree stand.
Yeah.
Yeah, he may kill a good buck every year because he's got the time to put in the tree stand to wait for a deer that's coming from his
upwind. Yep.
Okay. So
yep.
Now I equate, and people argue with me about that all the time, especially with spot and stalk and stuff like that. I'm like, you can't control wind. You can't. So why not take any variable that you can sort of control?
Yep.
Control it.
Yep. Yeah. 100%.
I travel all over the country, So I was just watching last night. I was watching Major League Bow Hunter. And what's the guy's name? Duff.
Yeah.
Finally shoots a big buck that he's been after. He hunted that buck for 28 days straight. 28 days straight.
Jeez.
And the reason why I bring this up is most people don't have that kind of time. So like myself, I travel all over the country, on my hunts, and I pretty much have about 5 days to do it.
Yeah.
So I am going to do anything, everything in my power to maximize my opportunity.
Yeah.
100%. To harvest an animal. And I mean, I don't want to get up on my soapbox and beat my chest at how awesome of a hunter I am. I have a very high success rate. And the reason why is because I pay attention to the details and I take care of those little things. I use the best equipment. I control my scent. I wear the best camouflage. I shoot the best guns. I shoot the best, arrows and bows and everything else. And because I have to do anything and everything possible to make up for the fact that I don't have 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or a whole season, whatever it is, to get it done when you're traveling to hunt. Now, if you're just, the guy that goes out and hunts, in his home state and he's got a whole season to get it done, these guys are very successful because they know their terrain, they know their hunting, and they got
patterns.
The time to do it. They got the time to do it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and that's, you know, the one thing for me, there's a little, and, you know, I know we're kind of drawing this out here, but one thing for me that a kind of a different way to look at it too is, here's kind of an example. I was 21, 22 years old, and I'd never really golfed before. And mm-hmm. I went out and golfed, and, you know, I did a little research on what good clubs were, and, you know, I knew that I liked the game. So I went out and I spent, I don't know, $2,500 on a full bag of clubs, you know, irons and all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my friends is like, why did you go out and do that? You just started golfing. I said, because I don't want to have anything to blame but me. I want to know that I've got the best equipment, and if something fails, it was my fault. I don't have anywhere else to point the blame. So, you know, it's kind of backing up what you're saying. If you have the best of the best equipment, and you know your equipment performs and you've tested it, then if you fail, it's on you. You know what I mean? I've missed deer with my bow and gone, what the heck happened? Well, then I realized, holy cow, I never adjusted my sight. Or you know, I wasn't anchored solid, or, you know, whatever. I was canted a little bit, you know. There's the equipment won't fail. It's you. You know what I mean? So that's, for me, I'm the type of person I'd rather beat myself up than blame it on something that doesn't fail, you know.
So. Yeah, for sure. No, absolutely. No, and I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I've had that conversation with many people before. And I actually, for my own personal, here's another thing too. Like, I spent a ridiculous amount of money over times. Okay, I'm gonna equate it back to glass because it's a very easy thing and a big subject that people argue all the time.
Yeah.
My first pair of binos, I spent maybe $300 on.
Yeah.
I went out, found that I wasn't as effective as some of the other guys, so I went and bought another pair of binos. That was the next step up. You know, I went from Nikons, and then I got some, you know, Zeiss Conquest, and then from there I bought some Fujinon. And eventually, I end up buying the Saguaros anyway.
Yeah.
So instead of me going through that process and losing, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50% on the resale of those ones that I bought beforehand, yeah, I did it with backpacks. I did it with everything. And it's just like, I'm like, I'm here to tell you, and I tell people all the time, it's like, save your money and buy the best of what you want, you know?
Yeah.
Don't rush out and buy this just so you know, stick with what you got for now, and until you can afford that really good thing, don't just go to the next level, because you're going to end up selling it, and, you know, it's just,
It's for, you know, for me, a situation that it can cost you animals in, too, is, you know, me, when I go out hunting with some of my buddies, Steve McIntosh, I understand you're going to have him on pretty soon, but we have an animal hunt that we do, you know, Western South Dakota mule deer. And how we do it is, if you spot them, you got them, right?
Right.
So if you spot the deer, you get to say, okay, well, I'm going to go after this deer, or nah, you know what, I'm going to pass on them. You can have an opportunity at them, right? Well, if you're using inferior glass and you're not spotting the animals, it's going to be a long week for you, you know? Of course, there's technique that goes into glassing, but like you said, I mean, the old saying, buy once, cry once, when it comes to something like that, it really is true, you know? You just can't cut corners on glass, you know? That's just the one thing where, you know, it's gonna kill you, you know? So
Yeah. Well, before we start a whole nother topic, don't get me started on any of this, I'll go for days, but where can listeners find out more about you?
You know, to be honest, like I say, I used to be real active in the pro staff stuff and spend a lot of time plugging stuff on social media. And kind of what I figured out is that the pro staff world has kind of gotten a little saturated. And so what I do is I just do my thing and share what I want on Facebook when I have time. And, and you know, if someone gains something out of it, they gain something. I get, you know, periodically I'll get questions. Hey, you know, I just bought a new rifle. What can I do to make it shoot good? And I'll spend the time. I have no problem spending the time with someone if they've got any questions or anything like that. So, you know, Facebook is, of course, the, you know, god of social media still. That's the best way to get a hold of me if anyone should need to. Otherwise, you know, I'm always ears for anyone that wants to learn something. That's for sure. Yep.
Well, awesome, man. I appreciate you taking the time, and definitely have you on again. Me and you can sit here and rant about everything else, because you almost started another topic with me about pro staff. Don't want to get me going on that one. So
no, I hear you there, and that's something where there's still a valid, you know, maybe we can do a follow up at some time, John. But in my opinion, there's still a valid need for it.
For sure.
But, you know, I think that, you know, people need to understand what their responsibilities as a pro staffer are, you know, and that would help them benefit themselves and the companies they represent. But another one too, and maybe this is where you cut it, but, or we can go back or whatever. But another one I'd like to do is maybe get in more depth about reloading. You know, we could almost do one on that. There's a wealth of knowledge out there, but, you know, I guess for me, I've been able to take all four of my Alliance builds and shoot sub quarter minute. And a lot of that guidance comes from guys like Steve McIntosh and Brent and Chris Meyer and stuff. I mean, those guys are a wealth of knowledge when it comes to that stuff. And so basically, I guess what I'd be doing is just repeating what they've taught me for the most part. But that would be a good one.
Awesome. Well, sounds good, man. I'll get with you. We'll put another one together here and probably before the end of the season for sure.
Good
having you on, man, and I hope 2017 is good to you.
I should have a couple decent tags. So last year, to be honest, on my whitetail hunt, I just got completely lucky. It was my first big game hunt with my dad. First 15 minutes ever hunting big game with my dad, and I shot a monster whitetail buck. And So, you know, I got really blessed last year, but I think this year is going to be like every other year where I have to put the work in. So I'm excited, though.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for being on, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, John.